stay tuned for The Lynn Show. In this show, I am playing the first half of an interview I did with Michael Royal. And when you listen to and watch Michael Royal play the piano, you know that he and his piano and his music are one, and that he is inside it, being completely and wholly who he really is. I was interested to discover that Michael is like that in so many areas of his life. His intellectual curiosity is staggering. His ability to become fascinated with, curious about, attached to a wide and diverse number of different disciplines and activities, art forms, and then to suck them up, essentially, absorb them. And I'm quite sure that they all find their way into his music. So here comes Michael Royal. Okay, so I'm here with Michael Royal, an extraordinary musician who is not only unfailingly interesting to listen to, but even interesting to watch, because you can see when Michael is playing that nothing exists except him and that piano. Of course, he can tell me if I'm wrong about that, but that's what it looks like from the outside. So I'm going to tell him what I tell everybody, that I interview people who make their living or their life with their art. It seems to me that Michael qualifies absolutely. And what I want to know is, how did it happen? How did it find you? How did you find it? How did it capture you? How did you know it? When did it begin?
Well, I grew up in Tampa. Mm-hmm. Was born in the early 50s. And my grandfather was the chief electrician for the U.S. Phosphoric Plant, which has undergone a bunch of different names, Cargill, Gardner. Anyway, it's that plant with the on 41 in between Tampa and Ruskin. On the Alafaya River that has that mountain of phosphate slag. Mm-hmm. Anyway, those were my haunts when I was a kid. My granddad was the chief electrician out there, and they had a house. He lived on location. And he and my grandmother both played the piano. And they had an old Hallett and Davis upright. Mm-hmm. And I was very young. And they used to sit and play duets, no music. And they would play all this really old stuff like I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles and The Naughty Waltz and, you know, this thing where, you know, she'll play a chord and she'll shake it, you know, and that was kind of supposed to be a little off color. And
how old were you?
Maybe 5, 6 at the most. Wow. And I used to fool around at the piano, and they were beautiful sitting there together playing. And I could see how to connect from watching them. It wasn't a show. It was a serious, self-indulgent, undistracted activity. And that had every character of whatever the music was that you were playing. If the music was fun, then everybody was having fun. If the music was sad, people were crying. Mm-hmm. It was, and so I connected with my heart and the music at a very early age from watching them.
Yes.
And a whole bunch of stuff happened in those days. My first encounter with racism happened out there. Remember, I grew up in the Deep South, and all of my family were native Floridians, farmers. So people were polarized racially and nationally. You know, there was a pecking order about black people and about Mexicans and about Cubans and about anyone who wasn't WASP. Mm-hmm. And, or cracker, if you will. And there was this old guy that used to work in the yard named Skeeter. He was an Uncle Remus type. Very gentle, soft-spoken. you know, always a growth of gray stubble on his face. And he used to roll his own cigarettes and give me puffs. You know, and we were buddies.
Mm-hmm.
So it was Thanksgiving Day one day, and he was working in the yard on Thanksgiving Day.
Mm-hmm.
And we all came in for dinner, and they called Skeeter in for dinner too, but Skeeter had eaten the kitchen. And me, being the upstart that I am, said, "Mama, how come Skeeter has to eat out in the kitchen?" And my grandmother responded from my mother. And she said, "Well, Michael, he's more comfortable out there." And I said, "Well, Mama, do you mind if I go out and eat with Skeeter? Because he's by himself." She said, "No, I don't mind. Go ahead." So I did. So we're eating and we're hanging. And I said, "Skeeter, are you really more comfortable out here?" And that's when I got my first big lesson about that world.
Yeah.
And he said, "Michael, your grandmother is a fine woman. The truth is, she's more comfortable with me out here."
Smart man.
And I got it. And I immediately opened my heart up to a world of people that had been closed off to me because of my family's prejudice. They weren't bad people. They were just, that was the way people thought in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of the transition points. So this is background for how I got interested in black music.
Aha.
So fast forward, I'm going through school, I'm taking piano lessons.
When did you start taking piano lessons?
About the same time, 5 or 6.
Did you ask? Did they volunteer? Do you
My great-grandmother, who actually owned the piano.
This is your mother's mother's mother? Is that what we're talking about here,
right.
Your great-grandma?
Right. She owned the piano and gave it to me for my 5th birthday.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, because Granddad and Nana had moved to another place, and Granddad had retired from the plant, and so what do we do with the piano? Well, we'll give it to Michael.
Who we saw playing around with it anyway.
Right. I mean, I remember the first thing I ever played on that piano. It was a miserable piece of shit piano. everything worked on it, but it was kind of out of tune, but it also was, I mean, I didn't have really refined auditory perception in those days, but other than the fact that I could hear a lot of stuff inside a single note. So I used to play D flat below middle C only.
And listen.
Ad nauseum. Indeed. My mother used to tell me, "If you don't play something different, I'm going to break your hands off." But I was enamored by what happened when you actually, it was almost like you disconnected from this world and connected to another world as soon as you hit a note.
Yeah, so I'm not wrong about what happens to you when you play.
No.
Yeah.
No. I had formal training when I was about that time. Formal meaning my church organist. I had lessons every Saturday morning. I was a terrible reader. You know, I was strictly played by heart or by
literally.
Ear. Yeah, yeah. Literally, that's a very important distinction.
I think so.
Because by ear is absence of heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or you might get it and you might not get it if you're doing it by ear. But playing by heart was you might miss notes, but you got the right spirit. This is how children communicate. I mean, I have 2 children who I raised. And I often said if I could keep a 2-year-old around the house, just for the innocent awakening of how life occurs for them and the things that they'd say. And when they had no vocabulary and they had no way to really vocalize what's on their mind, you could understand them if you paid attention. They said it very badly, but their heart was in it.
Yes, and that's what communicates.
And that's how I started playing music, from that same space. So I took lessons every Saturday morning, all through grammar school and junior high school. Got in rock bands when I was in high school. All my buddies were into the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And at that time, the most extraordinary thing I'd ever heard on the piano was the extended version of Light My Fire by the Doors. I said, "Wow, this guy's really getting down on this solo." Right? Then I met my first musical mentor, who was a guy named Majid Shabazz. And he was Pharoah Sanders' drummer in New York City. Pharoah Sanders was neck and neck with John Coltrane for who is the most sophisticated jazz saxophonist in the world.
Wow.
In keeping with the Flower Child movement and all of that, there was a huge spiritual movement going on with the older, more mature musicians. And Majid introduced me to the music of Coltrane and the music of the bebop players. Basically, introduced me to an adult world of music, mm-hmm. as opposed to the world of pop music, which is based on the angst of teenagers. And so after I listened to most rock and roll music of that time was built on the blues, a 12-bar structure, a 1-4-5 changes, and with a little solo in between. I really never realized that you could actually build a group around what the solo is supposed to be about. And after I heard Coltrane and his band with Elvin and McCoy and Jimmy, that was it. I said, man, my idea of love is not two kids making out in the back of a 57 Chevy. It's Billie Holiday and her pathetic, ironic tune called Strange Fruit. You know, it really talks about adult feelings.
Yes.
And adult emotions and an adult understanding of life and death and love. And so I immediately separated myself from all of my friends who
okay.
I was growing up with.
And how old are you now?
15.
Wow. It's interesting because it parallels a little bit the way you separated yourself from the culture of your family. I mean, you're kind of a transition guy in a lot of places.
Well, yeah, it's funny because I'm almost 60 now. Mm-hmm. And as I look back, I've been in the human potential movement most of my life because I never could come to terms with why my family was so dysfunctional and why I, as a part of it, felt so dysfunctional and so disempowered when I had all these bright thoughts and abilities, and yet I didn't really feel like I was worth a shit in anything.
Yeah.
And so I had no identity, and I had no moral conscience, if you would, which was formulated through the 60s.
You mean you came into the 60s without it? You came out of your...
No, I came into the 60s without knowing that I had it.
Yes, because it's quite clear that you had it.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And actually, that isn't true either. I came in at odds with it.
Yes, but again, that's that pattern. I mean, that's that through line in your life. I don't know, maybe you don't see it, or maybe you think I'm wrong.
Interesting observation. So after... during high school, after I found out about Coltrane, it was time to go to college. I could play. I was already making gigs. Everybody else was bagging groceries or working at a gas station, which were high school jobs in those days. And I was making $150 every time I went out to play. Mm-hmm. So, and I was enjoying it.
I'll bet you were.
So I said, this is, why should I go into business with all these academic idiots? I kind of called them that because they didn't really see any value to the music that I was immediately getting and understanding.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted to do what they're still doing today, listen to what they listened to in high school. Mm-hmm. I decided I'm going to be a musician for a living. So I went to college. There I met my second mentor. A concert pianist who had a career in the 40s when it actually meant something to be a concert musician. I went to play in his master class, and I was, of course, the most inexperienced of all his students. He was the top professor at the university and had his choice of the best of the best. So he had, this master class with students from all over the world. I was playing gigs. one of my first road gigs with the rock stars of the 50s, the Diamonds. Now, there were a lot of incarnations of that. And I happened to hit before the Sha-na-na nostalgia wave came around, which was the mid-70s. So I was on the road with them in the 69-70, touring the United States and Canada. And got a taste of showbiz. And turns out the guitar player, who was a musical director, I was playing piano and kick and bass. I had a bass unit that I played with my feet. And I was back in the band that way. And this guitar player was yet another step in my musical maturing. Because like every night, we would go back and we'd listen to Miles. And we would learn how to sing the solos. So again, I'm like formulating these tried and true ways of retaining the music.
Right. It's inside you.
Yeah. That was very unacademic.
Right.
And yet I was learning how to translate them into academic terms because people wanted to know how I'm doing it. So I began to teach. And I've had students over the years. So I was on the road with the Diamonds for a year and a half. Came back from the Diamonds, met a woman 20 years older than me, fell in love with her, hitchhiked in the dead of winter to Minneapolis because we met someone on the beach that we thought was cool, who lived up there. Those were the kind of days that were. We just whimsically went where it felt like it was going to be right. So we went to Minneapolis, had no money, no place to stay, called this youth emergency service hotline. I mean, this is Hubert Humphrey country, you know, the most progressive country, state in the union. And Gloria Steinem lives there, you know. So we're there and we call the service and this woman answers it and she happens to be a school teacher who was a banker's daughter. And she said, well, look, you sound like very interesting people. Why don't you come to our house for a night?
Wow.
So we did, and they ended up being these incredibly affluent people who have a Frank Lloyd Wright house on Lindale Boulevard with, you know, Italian frescoes, a walk-in vault, you know, you know, matched paneling cut from the same log. I mean, this real high-end stuff. And we ended up staying there for a year. And it wasn't a freeload. It was, we were there because they wanted to be in the world we were bringing to them just as badly as we wanted to be taken care of.
Right.
So meanwhile, I'm finding people in Minneapolis to play with, and I land the best gig in Minneapolis, which is the IDS Tower Orion Room on the 50th floor. So I'm playing up there and playing with all these players in town, and I make enough money to put a down payment on a contract for deed for a house and buy a house. So now I'm 21.
My God.
So at 21, I own my own house, own my own car, own my own piano, supporting a household of seven. She had five kids from another marriage, which I went to court and got custody of all of them.
Hi.
After 7 years, the age difference started to make a difference to her, not to me. I had gone to this little Presbyterian college called St. Andrews because there were all these people like Marcia there who were all studying. So I was in one of the practice rooms, and I was rocking out. And this old bald-headed guy pokes his head in the door, and I immediately get paranoid because I'm not a student. And I'm certainly not playing Bach and Beethoven. And he says, who are you? And I told him. He says, where are you from? I told him. He says, what are you doing here? And I told him. He said, well, I like what you're playing. He says, would you do me a favor? I am charged with introducing a jazz program this upcoming year. He says, I know nothing about it. Would you come to my house and we'll take my credit card and go buy me a library and you can coach me on who's who?
Oh my God.
Because we ended up becoming very, very good friends.
Clearly.
His wife was Swiss. Her name was Olga. And he had two daughters. And so in this year of getting ready to leave my wife, I had met Dr. Herbert Horn, who has expired this year, as a matter of fact. And they go to Switzerland to vacation every year. And he says, well, you know, if you ever want to come over and visit. And I said, cool. Well, I'd been playing these gigs. I had this money in my pocket. I had a marriage that was on the rocks. Where do you want to go? I went to the airport. And there's Zurich. Flashing on. I said, that's it. I'm going. So in those days, you could buy a ticket for $200 round
right,
trip.
Right.
So I said, I'm going for 2 weeks. I'm gone. So I got this ticket and showed up over there, and it was the most incredible journey of my life. I was supposed to stay for 2 weeks, ended up staying for a year and a half. This truly is the highlight of my life. Herbert Horn's wife, Olga, had a sister, and her name was Leah Carl. And her husband, Bruno Carl, is this genius, writing a world history book like Goethe in 7 volumes.
Right.
And they're Swiss rich. If you know anything about the money world, that's serious money. Mm-hmm. And they made all of their family money during the war in textiles. So they live in this Spanish villa in on the lake of Zurich, you know, with a wine cellar that's fully stocked. And they live a 19th century lifestyle. There's no TV. There is one telephone in a very remote part of the house, so they're not annoyed by it. There's always Bach in the morning. You know, they're very stern people. They would smoke cigarettes, but one time a day. And they would come out and they would only have one. And they would have, you know, 1 or 2 glasses of wine with dinner, and that was it. Nothing to excess, but not prudish either. And a very elegant way to live, I thought. And we went to dinner at their house on the second night that I was staying with the Horns. And Leah Carl, who, I mean, this is way... The woman's movement is going, but this was a woman on the same footing with someone like Madame Curie or Amelia Earhart. She was just great, but not because she was female, because she was great.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so even though she was raising these children with Bruno and helping him research his book, they had a fabulous library, multilingual library, and between them they had 9 languages. And had all of these wonderfully annotated books that they've had for all these years that they've built this library into. So they would like take brisk walks after dinner, arm in arm, talking about his book, talking about which way the missiles are pointed now, talking about relevant shit. And I got to know them and find out this is a remarkable family. And so that first meeting, that night at dinner, Leah makes the announcement that she has just published a book of Shakespeare's sonnets into High German with the metric footage preserved. So I'm going, this is great. I always looked at Shakespeare from mountain to mountain. I never knew anything about him, really. I didn't know what a sonnet was. I knew some of the characters of some of the plays that I risked through in high school, but that was about it. And so from this meeting, I became enlightened about poetry, about sonnet in specific. So they ran to the library and got like 6 or 7 books. And so we all read the same sonnet, I think it was number 51, in different languages, to see if musically we could connect what the form was. A lot of Shakespeare's sonnets adhere to a very simple rhyme scheme. There's 14 lines to a sonnet. And 1 and 3 rhyme, 2 and 4 rhyme, 5 and 7 rhyme, 6 and 8 rhyme. And then there's a change in point of view. Then 7 and 9 rhyme, 8 and 10 rhyme, 9 and 11 rhyme, and 13 and 14. The last 2 verses not only rhyme, but they function as a punchline, like a joke. So this can be a very epic format, like Japanese haiku. It's very, very short, but a lot of stuff can go on inside. So I'm jumping.
Yeah,
I'm excited about you know, all of a sudden I'm picking up books and I'm notating the rhythm of words down. And I'm looking way beyond, you know, the pop notion of the day of what hooks are in rock and roll music.
Right.
I'm looking way beyond that. And so now I'm looking into great poets. You know, poets like T.S. Eliot, who use syntax in a very sophisticated way. Anyway, I could go on and on and on about all of the things that enlightened me and that contributed to my musical development. Anyway, after the third day of hanging with them, they said, you know, we want you here. You know, we want you here. We love your American energy, and we love your willingness to not bow unscrupulously to authority. We like your moral conscience about war. We like your sensibility about love. We
and
want that in
wrong,
our house.
And there's nothing wrong with your curiosity either.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So we want you to stay. We're going to give you a $500 a week stipend. We're going to give you a room with a view of the Alps with a piano in it. We want you to compose symphonies. We want you to compose piano concertos and sonatas and chamber music. And I'm going, geez, I'm going, this is not really who I am. I mean, I'm not trained to do that shit yet. So over there, being around them, I learned about architecture. They knew the floor plans of all of the, and like as you pursue each subject, which today we're going to see a cathedral. Well, I went to see the Grossmünster Cathedral, which Bruno promptly showed me a floor drawing and told me all the names of the parts of the architecture and who the architects were and how this stacks up in terms of great cathedrals in this part of Europe and so on and so forth. And
it's a college education. It's better.
And it was like real time, though, because you know, it was like, you know, these guys were perched way above the intelligentsia of the area. They were doing it, you know, was there. And so when I went to the Grossmünster Cathedral to finish that story, I walked up and I was alienated from the Christian doctrine, very spiritually awake, but really was tired of Oral Roberts and Ernest Angley and Bishop Sheen and all the bullshit they were spoon-feeding us in those days. And somehow I was disenamored with the mysteries of the Church of Rome. But it still had questions about the Christian canon that I kept alive and still have alive today. So anyway, I'm entering this church and all of that kind of runs through my head, you know, and I hear this angelic choir that I determined can only be a young boys' choir. They had this just pure angelic sound. I'm saying it sounds like a bunch of castratas, mm-hmm. you know? And so I walked up to the front of the church, I turned around to look at the organ, and it's a mixed men and women's choir who are being coached to sing that way by this remarkable organist. Another, you know, fringe benefit of my pursuit of to check out this cathedral, I find out the history of the music of this establishment, that Bach has played here, and that Handel has played here, and that Buxtehude has played here, and that all these great organists have played here. And he was the Kapellmeister, which was the post that Bach held in Leipzig. And so we had this long conversation. He gave me a piece that he had written, a vocal piece on a theme by Rilke. I said, who is Rilke? Boy, you into something. So my education is expounding exponentially.
Yeah, right.
I mean, every encounter I meet sends me joyously to a new source to investigate. And meanwhile, I'm still playing gigs. I'm not making any money. Didn't have the intellectual fortitude or the personal self-discipline to take advantage of the very generous offer that they had to pay me to develop my career. So I spent my time going to bars and playing and romancing women and walking the streets of Zurich and traveling around Europe and eagerly staying inside this conversation with this family. So I've got all this other educational stuff that came from that. That really was the highlight of my youth. It really solidified. I mean, I saw some great performances when I lived there. We went to the theater every week. We went to the ballet every week. We went to the opera every week. We went to the Kunsthaus 3 or 4 times a week, which is the art museum. And, you know, we would take trips to all around the country of Zurich, the country of Switzerland, which is very small, just to see how the architecture changed from canton to canton. And, you know, I learned all these distinctions, like there's a Baroque cathedral in St. Gall, which has no stained glass windows and is painted white, and all Baroque cathedrals are. I didn't know this. And there was this the big mural on the ceiling that's got this distinction called Trompe l'œil, which is the whole thing is painted in you know, very dark colors, and the clear plate glass and the not plate glass but Coke bottle glass kind of. And the white was really striking to this dark ceiling. And it was all of these biblical depictions. And there was one of Jonah being swallowed by the whale. And his foot was on the edge, was sculpted out.
Out, coming out, right? Yeah.
The only part of the entire painting that was like that.
You're kidding.
So I said, what is that? He said, that's Trompe l'œil. It's like...
Right.
So anyway, I stayed in Europe for, at that time, I lived in Zurich for a year and a half and then moved to Copenhagen. So, to answer your question about, you seem to be one with the piano. The key this is the underlying theme of all of these people that I'm drawn to. They are what they do.
They are what they do, that's right.
You want to be in the music, become the music.
And if anybody knows what it means to become the music, it is very definitely Michael Royal. So that was the first half of my interview with Michael, and it brings him up to the time when he moves back to Sarasota, which we are all incredibly grateful for, because we can hear him here quite often. So now I'm going to play Green Dolphin Street from his CD, Transition. And this is the Michael Royal Trio with Richard Drexler on bass and Steve Davis on drums. And in case you want to get this CD, you can just go up on Michael's website, michaelroyal.com, and there you can get the CD or find out where Michael is playing or arrange to take piano lessons from Michael. Or hire him to play at your club or your party or your event. Or you could just sit and listen to the website where Michael is playing. So, now, Green Dolphin Street with the Michael Royal Trio. Thank you. So I told you, right? Pretty terrific. Next week, you can hear the second half of my interview with Michael and more of his music. I'm